This is a podcast on BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin, and my series is called Setting the Record Straight, attempting to straighten out some of the common myths about history, to expose the black legend about the Catholic Church for what it is, war propaganda. And in this particular podcast, directed more toward the outer culture of the general cultural ocean that we all swim in, sometimes without landmark, sometimes without direction. Come with me and let's open our eyes and our ears. Let's open our senses to what is real and to bring Christ's moral compass again before our eyes. Are we off course? So we're going to talk about the general culture. We're going to talk comparative religions for a while and the fascination with some of the older religions that preceded the birth of the baby Jesus. The birth of the baby Jesus. I sort of like saying that beautiful phrase for what comes up in my mind when I say the birth of the baby Jesus. Okay, but back to business. We're also going to talk about some very attractive and successful and seductive alternate philosophies to the good news that that little baby brought within him. Within that body were the directions that would guide us to paradise, to heaven, to rest in the body of Christ. One of the absolutely fascinating cultural phenomenons that I'm talking about, cultural memes, is Lust for the Mud, the title of this program. Of course, in France, it's a cliché. En français, nostalgie de la boue. Yes, it's nostalgia for the mud. The term nostalgie, when used in French, means something stronger than we mean by nostalgia. An irresistible draw to return to the mud, to return to the primitive, to return to the gloriously uncleaned up state of the primitive life, the muddy life. Nostalgie de la boue. What a rich, sultry, and robust phrase. Back in the last century, when you went down hitting the bars in the worst section of town, it was called for fun slumming it. Let's go slumming. A roll in the mud, in the half-light, in a beard whiskey fog, music blasting from the lower chakra. Lovely chaos, lovely chaos. Nostalgie de la boue. Our love for the primitive. Our search for something more natural and more pure. As natural as we were when we were newborns. Free of this sophisticated world. Unmarked by this sophisticated world. The very sound of it sounds like a great idea. Let's do it. Ah, but it's often a delusion. That's what we're going to talk about. So, come friends, let's get started. Let's go on a bit of a tour. How about the Dark Ages? Wasn't that as unstructured and chaotic as mud itself? Well, no. Actually, the Dark Ages weren't dark at all. There's a book, The Legend of the Middle Ages, by Remy Brago, who demonstrates the simple fact, for the heart of medieval Europe was neither dark nor golden, neither bestial nor angelic. Instead, Europe had at its core a profound sense of humility. A humility that, in Brago's words, never hesitated to go elsewhere to seek what it lacked. Authenticity was never so important that it won out over a primordial desire for what is true, beautiful, useful, and interesting. Most importantly, humility led medieval Europeans to the true source for what is true, beautiful, useful, and interesting. It led them to God. Contemporary Europe, by cutting itself off from this source of both humility and ennoblement, is in danger of nodding off. It is against this complacency and lack of humility that the historian can remind us of our indebtedness to the past and our dependence on events beyond our control. So what aspect of our life are we looking at today? When we're looking for an alternative to the careful restrictions of the moral world, the Christian world we live in, where will we look? Look at the old-time religions. Sounds good. We can look back at the old religions. Give me some of that.
Give me that old-time religion. Now, the old-time religion I'm talking about is probably a lot older than that saying implies. I'm talking about ancient tribal religions. Religions that go back thousands of years or where we have preliterate societies. We don't know how recently they were invented. Maybe last year. 10,000 years ago, maybe 100,000 years ago. But what's particularly interesting to consider is how they are regarded today, because there's been a rebirth of interest in them. Anthropologists have always been interested in writing down the details of these religions. For instance, the remarkable records that the French Jesuits left in the Jesuit relations. They were great missionaries, intelligent and caring, and concerned for the people that they were evangelizing. Let's take in consideration what we do know for sure about the Indians around the Great Lakes in eastern Canada and the eastern United States, about the very detailed records about every aspect of the culture of the Indians in the Iroquois Confederacy and the Mi'kmaq Confederacy that the French Jesuits recorded in meticulous detail. One praiseworthy aspect of the Jesuits is their sensitivity to the native cultures. They always learned the language in as many details as they could about the habits and lives of these people before even beginning their evangelization efforts. When you read the Jesuit relations, you will see that they treated them not only with respect, but with very sincere love. How different this is than the popular misconceptions about these missionaries. I remember in my university days when I was studying the humanities, the course's content divided the Western European culture into three phases: classicism, romanticism, and realism. Of course, being 17, 18, and 19 years old, I was very taken with the romantic impulse. And of particular interest for this program is one of the aspects or characteristics that was listed for the romantic period in human history was a love of the exotic. And you will really find this to be true. One of the foundational concepts of the romantic movement is the idea of, quote, the noble savage, unquote. The noble savage views primitive man as existing in a more pure and innocent and virtuous state than modern civilized man. Well, this implies something rather obvious, that we'd improve ourselves by rejecting modern civilization, technology, and culture, including the center of the culture, the cult. Reject Christianity and return to a pure, more sinless, and noble and virtuous state. This is the idea of the noble savage. We'll return to a far more gentle way of life. So this was the concept of the noble savage, and many people succumbed to it. And any even lightweight examination of history or anthropology will quickly reveal that there's no truth in it at all. The noble savage is a myth, but it's a very persistent myth because it's so delightful. Just relax and everything will be fine. The noble savage contrasted with the depravity of the modern bishop. This kind of inverted thinking is very risky, and it's done a great deal of damage in the last part of the 20th century and the first decades of the 21st. But if someone is sufficiently intoxicated by wishful thinking, they may turn their eyes upon these cultures and see only the reflection of their own romantic imagination. If someone is ruthlessly objective, they could quickly discover the truth, could quickly find out that the whole thing was a fantasy, had no basis in reality. Its basis was in wishful thinking. But we're living in an age when a large number of people, perhaps even a majority, entertain this false conception as being true. And it has been combined with another impulse, the adolescent impulse to love chaos. The combined force of these two cultural impulses has resulted in a storm of chaos. Nostalgie de la boue, nostalgia for the mud. A desire, even a longing, to return to the primitive. An accumulative effect, unfortunately, has been a decay and decomposition of a carefully and laboriously constructed great culture. Nostalgie de la boue is an attraction to the crude, to the primitive. It is obviously the most powerful impulse in our music, and few things are more mind-shaping than music. So the attraction to the primitive and to the crude and to a romantic false image of past primitive times became the most powerful current in our culture and shaped us. It was based upon a rejection of the wisdom of our parents and of our ancestors. It was an extension of the adolescent's rebellion, of all the valuable inheritance of his culture. It was an extension of the rebellious adolescent spirit into adulthood, into our adulthoods. And these perpetual adolescents took over the leadership positions in our society. We turned over the steering wheels of our society to a generation of 50-year-old adolescents. And the wreckage it produced in our culture is abundantly obvious to those with honest eyes. Yes, the very influential concept of the noble savage was originated in the 18th century by the famous French philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Rousseau has had great influence because of this concept and had a great revival in the 20th century in what is referred to as the culture of the 60s. The beatniks in the 50s originated it, but in the 60s and 70s it came to maturity in what is sometimes called a hippie culture. People who practiced that culture gave great interest and attention to alternatives to Christianity. And there were a lot of books that came out of that, like Conversations with God and The Law of Attraction. Some people call this New Age. It was sort of a syncretic movement, a sort of invent your own, like a cafeteria. Pick a little bit from this religion, a little bit from that religion. Or you could think of it as theological modules, like Tinker Toys. Let's combine this module from this religion with that module from that religion. That sounds pretty thrilling, doesn't it? Well, what's wrong with that idea? Well, if you're a divine being putting it together, you probably can design a religion that is based on wisdom about the truth, about a lack of self-interest in perceptions of reality. But if one's character is lacking in discipline, one will duct tape together certain modules of religion selected for self-indulgent reasons. That is composed only of the comfortable religious concepts and none of the uncomfortable religious concepts. You will construct a religion that is an intoxicating drug rather than a lens through which divine light reveals reality. Let me tell you how I'm using the term syncretic to describe this cultural phenomenon. Let's go to that great cultural monument, the Wikipedia, and see what it says about the syncretic or syncretism. Okay, here's the Wikipedia definition. Syncretism is the combining of different, often seemingly contradictory beliefs. While melding practices of various schools of thought, syncretism involves the merger and analogizing of several originally discrete traditions, especially in the theology and mythology of religion, thus asserting an underlying unity and allowing for an inclusive approach to other faiths. For lack of a better term, we can call it the New Age faith, though many might find that an objectionable term. It can vary quite a bit, but it has certain central features, which are often dogmatically and ardently asserted as being essential. One of these is reincarnation. Respect for the 10,000-year-old phenomenon called Hinduism, which is not so much an organized religion with easily integrated components, as it is a gradual collection of a few thousand tribal religions. Underlying all this was an attempt to find a religion that didn't interfere with oneself, with one's desires, with one's bodily impulses, with one's desire for intoxication and free love. If there wasn't a religion already like that, one could simply construct it. That may not be what a syncretic religion always has to be, but in our time, that unfortunately is what syncretic religion has proved to be. So in the middle of the 20th century, there was a need for intellectual justification for these syncretic beliefs.
So why don't you and I take a look at those, keeping in mind that it is the Roman Catholic Church that has always been freedom's defender. It was the Catholic Church that nurtured free discussion, open minds, and inquiry. It was the Catholic Church that nurtured the artistic expression of the Renaissance, that unfolded the endlessly beautiful artistic improvisations of the Baroque period. It was the Catholic Church that sponsored the intellectual freedom and literary freedom, write what you want, of the humanists, the great humanists. It was the Catholic Church that affirmed man's free will and made a true individual of him, a creature of God. A separate creature, yes, but in the body of Christ. Having a will, being three-dimensional, not a portrait on the wall, not a puppet. Having a will. Freedom, my friend. Freedom. We're free to be good or bad. What a great gift God has given us in our free will. The gift to be bad is a gift. We make our own fate. Finally, the penultimate thing I'm going to say about this. It was the global Roman Catholic Church, the small c Catholic Universal Church, that was God's tool, God's medium, through which he gave us this culture, this Christendom, this Catholicdom. They gave each of us the ultimate freedom beyond our free will. We were free from the state. The state was not the highest authority at all. Our rights are from God. And God speaks to us, reaches to us, touches us, becomes incarnate in us in the communion, in the Eucharist, and sets us free to be bad if we want to. Yet he gives us the grace, the wisdom, and the knowledge to be good. He gives us the knowledge to be good. The lust for the mud is what this podcast is called. Nostalgie de la boue.
Because what I'm discussing is the tendency of recent decades for our culture to abandon Christianity and to search in the attics of the past for scraps of this religion and that religion and to sort of duct tape them together into a pleasing arrangement to satisfy oneself. It's a syncretic religion. And as I said, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with assembling found objects. But if it's done to seek only the pretty and the comfortable and avoid the reality that the world is a polar place with good and evil, light and darkness, if the criteria for selecting objects for assemblage into a religion is self-indulgence, then the resulting religion may produce cultural disaster. Since all things in a culture are downstream of religion, are most heavily influenced by it, then it may produce a disaster. We're presently witnessing a cultural disaster, partly for the reason of these found object religions. So let's return to our subject. Needing a new syncretic religion, those who should have not led us wrong led us wrong. There was a failure of intellectual honesty. So we had the fraudulent scientific studies of human sexual activity by Masters and Johnson and by Kinsey, and the bogus anthropology of Margaret Mead, such as Margaret Mead's very popular little volume, Coming of Age in Samoa, which was read by all undergraduates in the 50s and 60s, that depicted a mythical sexual promiscuity among young women in Samoa, wherein the young that they had that were illegitimate were raised by the whole village in a sort of indiscriminate motherhood. It turned out that these were invented stories. There was a great deal of that kind of thing that took a very noble science of anthropology and plunged this noble science into a new dark age, the new age of even greater superstition that we entered around the 60s and 70s and have not yet emerged from. So at the university, my professors were dividing the last few thousand years of history into classicism, romanticism, and realism, led us to believe that we were living in a realistic age. But what we were entering, and are still in, is a deeper, darker romanticism, because it has a bright and beautiful side, and another side, which is a descent into ignorance, into darkness, and into superstition.
All right, I will confess to you, and perhaps this is unkind of me, but I mean it. I call our age the darker age of greater superstition. Why would I do that? Why would I use such strong terms?
Because we know so much that's not true. We've richly furnished the rooms of our mind with a lot of concepts that have no basis in reality, and too often rejected our Catholic heritage or Christian heritage. And the result has been the decomposition of society, starting with the decomposition of the basic building block of society, the family, and it seems to be accelerating. Many observers think that religion is on the decline in our time, but that's wrong. What is on decline is many of the sects of the Judeo-Christian tradition in the churches and synagogue. And also on decline is the desiccated secularism, which is the late offspring of that tradition. Secularism is on a decline too. But other, more ancient gods are alive and stirring. What is especially interesting, it is she that is on her way. She's stirring. The most ancient of all the great goddesses is on her way back. She was reborn some 30 years ago, appropriately enough, in the sunny, hedonistic empire of California. Looking back over the last few decades, one can see more and more clearly how one movement, after another, served to undermine one of the key foundations of Christendom. And what it sought to undermine and replace was the intimate relationship of each individual human soul with their one God. by substituting a polyamorous, promiscuous sexual relationship of sexual beings with other sexual beings. The sexual revolution was the starting point of all the other revolutions, each one attempting to destroy the intimate bond between the Christian God and the individual Christian person. And of course it began in 1960 with the introduction of the pill. The multicultural movement, rooted in the rediscovery of African and Asian experience, is in the process of dethroning the Eurocentrism of our culture. Scholarly feminists occupy the high chairs of academia, and they have been deconstructing what they see as the patriarchy, the egalitarian and anti-individualist impulses most recently coming together in the communitarian movement are putting in question the very notion of hierarchy on which all dominations rest, including the domination over the earth by the human race. People in this movement are envisioning not hierarchies but circles to organize human groups, and they seem so eager to deceive themselves. And the rediscovery of the Native American worldview is really the discovery of fictitious accounts of what that was really like, such as the fraudulent books of Carlo Castaneda's, perhaps the most famous one being the teaching of Don Juan, A Yankee Way of Knowledge, which represented itself as the true testimony of a real individual. But later it was realized that the book was fiction, and every word in it invented. But it was taken for being real, a real way to recover the ability of bilocation and other mystical experiences. It was fake, like so much of this movement. But we're hungry and credulous for a touch of the divine, and so many of us are seeking it everywhere but where it is. It would take some very powerful intellect that was our adversary to so mislead people. I wonder who's leading him to do that. In the new scheme of things, everything has rights, communal rights. The rights of each individual organism are the same as the rights of any other organism. And so we come to the point. This is what the adherents of these nature cults believe, which is the revelation of Gaia. The entire earth is a living entity. There is no hierarchy. Every organism has equal rights to the human being. Along with this came a decision to blame something. What is to blame for all of this trouble that the world is in? This new movement and this new age decided who and what to blame. It is above all the Bible that must be blamed. It is no accident that this book begins with a creation story in which the first human, a male, needless to say, is given domination over the earth and all its non-human inhabitants. The aforementioned thinkers have demonstrated in one case study after another how the repressive, racist, phallocentric, and hierarchical heritage of biblical religion has deformed Western culture. The Christian churches, of course, have been the chief vehicle of this monumental deformation, they say. But one must go back much earlier to find the origins of the process. There is an event that discloses dramatically what the issue is here. The contest on Mount Carmel between the prophet Elijah and the royal chaplains of King Ahab. You'll find this in the first book of Kings, chapter 18. Elijah, faithful to the first commandment of the Sinaitic Code, challenged the legitimacies of Ahab's multicultural clergy, bested them in a competition of magic tricks. Who were these people with whom Elijah struggled? The biblical text describes them as, quote, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. That table in the palace of Ahab's queen was evidently an earlier vision of an interfaith convention. The Baalim, of course, were the agriculturally oriented divinities of Canaan, worshipped in sexually liberated fertility cults. And as Asherah was just one of the many names given to the great goddess of the Near East, identical with the Mesopotamian Ishtar, whom the Greeks called Alstart and identified with their own Aphrodite. Okay, let's translate this into modern terms. Elijah was struggling with a multi-diverse core of eco-theologians and committed feminists. In retrospect, we can only agree with him that the worldview represented by these people was incompatible with the monotheistic faith of Israel. Okay, let's put on our time transport boots and step back to Mount Carmel. Step back and reopen the contest. We stand here in the middle of a crowd that hopes Elijah will be defeated this time. For this time, her moment has come. And this time, It looks like she may be winning. The ludicrousness of these delusions becomes apparent when we begin to restore our unity with nature. As soon as we look carefully, nature is neither nurturant nor benign. She is immensely indifferent to suffering and immensely profligate in the expenditure of individual existences.
So what is the message of these nature cults?
Well, they're telling us that in our essence, we're not individuals. We're small and significant in parts of the vast pulsating whole of cosmic life. We become healed as we surrender our delusional individuality to this whole. It is not the individual as sacred, but the life process as a whole, Gaia, the living earth. And nothing matters beyond the endless thrusting of the divine energy. As we stand here, look up. You can see it. You can see the vision. Gaia has another face. It has been revealed most fully in India, in Indian sacred art. It is there given the name of Talig Durga, consort of Shiva, the goddess who both gives and destroys life. She manifests herself, her mouth gaping to show bloody fangs. In her four hands she holds a noose, a skull-topped staff, a sword, and a severed head. She's dancing on a mountain of corpses. Many people perhaps think they are not yet ready for this vision. But I assure you, it is the future to which she calls us. And is the future to which many of you have already embraced. Those of us cheering on Christianity, we must not only overcome the cult of nature. It seems at this time we must now overcome humanism also. Western notions about the autonomy and the rights of the individual derive in a straight line from biblical religion. The very notion of the individual, as our culture has established it,
presupposes the separation of humankind and nature. And, of course, this came later in history, the separation of the person and society. American ideologues in particular have celebrated the sovereignty of the individual and the sacred character of individual rights. Each one of us can safely fall in love with God because God loves each individual person. Some people call it a personal relationship with God. It's much more than a personal relationship. Much, much more. Perhaps it should be described as an intimate spousal relationship with God. What a contrast that is to the urge to go native, to have lust for the mud, nostalgie de la boue. That's what the podcast is about so far. I'm going to go on, but I want to remind you to support our hosts. Look around the website. There's a way to keep us alive, to keep the lights on, to keep these podcasts coming. We have hundreds of them in the vault. There are going to be more put out on the website as time goes on. If you want to support me, I'd be greatly charmed. This brings us to the end of part one of Lust for the Mud. I look forward to you joining me in part two. More interesting stuff. Considering, focusing, paying attention to our inner urges, including the one to re-enter the mud, the primitive, the untouched state. The uncultured. The nostalgie de la boue. This is Chuck Coughlin on breadboxmedia.com.